Things in the Middle East have never really seemed darker. Israel's broadening its horizon on this war, taking on multiple fronts. And what does it really mean for us in the U.S., around the world? And what are we really looking at? I think it's really important with an issue like this to dig deep, find out this history, and really have an open conversation about it. And we'll get to that today. I don't want to hold anything back. I hope you guys enjoy the show. I hope it gets meaning deeply to you. And I really hope it begs questions. I hope that we can have a conversation about this that isn't you're anti-Semitic or you're an Islamophobe. No, I just want to talk about the war and maybe what some of its causes were. I think it's important to look at. And as you'll see in the rest of the show, we got a lot to talk about. So let's get right into it. All right. Recently, what's been going on in Israel, I'll be honest, I've been purposely not trying to take in every single piece of information as it comes in because it is sickening. It is sickening to see a war going on, especially to the capacity that it is. When you're talking about wars in the Middle East, it's always a gruesome guerrilla fight. And in those fighting situations, unless you are absolutely optimizing your training to the nines every single day, day in, day out, reporting properly, you're going to have a lot of civilian interactions, and a lot of those become deadly, as we can see with the Israeli numbers, right? I think it's gotten to the point now, we're not arguing whether we're trusting numbers from an unverified source here. We have thousands of people missing, mostly women and children. And when you look at the severity of the difference in death tolls, casualty numbers, well, I think it begs that question. What are we actually looking at? And I think I mentioned it in the intro there. What are we looking at? Okay. And I just want to let you guys know, this is an episode here. As I start to go a little bit deep into this history, I may say some things that'll trigger a YouTube algorithm. Someone's going to say something. And yeah, for that, all you got to do is go click subscribe, go follow us on the website there. We'll be posting episodes there all the time. If we ever get taken down, at least we have some freedom left. And yeah, that's about it. Just make sure that you're in the know, because I really do think this question is important, right? If you're going to look back and see what we're looking at, right? You see a lot of comparisons, in my opinion, to World War II. You can even look back to World War I, I would think. My honest take on it is that Israel and what they did, and if you hadn't seen it recently, they attacked not Iran directly, which I mistakenly thought was the case. They actually attacked a Iranian embassy over in Syria. Now, what this does is obviously provocation of war. You can't say it's not an act of war, but it goes deeper than that. It involves who's supporting Israel and who's not. Are we looking at the broadening scope of this war and the amount of targets that are now inflicted upon by Israel, right? We're no longer talking about just Hamas and just Palestine, right? We're talking about Hezbollah as well. Now we're talking about Syria and possibly involving Iran through directly attacking its proxy states, right? You're starting to beg the question of who's in charge here, who's making the decisions, and what ramifications is Israel facing? Because it's clear they're not facing a massive threat militarily at the moment. They're getting, you know, casualty victories that are staggering, especially when you're looking at it in terms of Gaza. Now, I saw some death tolls that were saying, I should go look this up and clarify, but I'll go off what was on top of my head when I was researching before. I think we're looking at something like 500 people dead from the hands of Israel in the West Bank. In Palestine itself, I want to say, what did they have? I think it was around 32,000-33,000 deaths, civilian death being 80-90% of that or more. And there's also deaths that are coming. So in Lebanon, I don't know why I couldn't remember that. Lebanon with Hezbollah, you got some death toll there. Now, opening up this can of worms, from Israel's perspective, right? You would think this can't come without an okay from Well, you would hope U.S. intelligence, at least, even if it was faulty, or other people. When you're talking about war nowadays, right? And this is a question that I want to pose to you guys. Is war, right? Looking back on it from what war became as we came to the 20th century, beginning of the 1900s and going into the two world wars. Has war ever really changed from that, right? Think about the alliance systems that have been built up and the amount of different red lines that get drawn in the sand all over the place. When you really think about it, what they're doing with trade to try to restrict on enemies now or foes or people that they don't agree with. Think about Russia, think about China. Everything is thought about on a world scale. Everything is a world war when someone is at war. And this is, you know, an opinion of mine that I've slowly started to feel, especially since things started happening in Ukraine and Russia, as things start to develop in the world, things start to really spiral, I think, is what we've witnessed over the past couple of years. But you can look back a lot further. And looking back a lot further is what I really want to do today. When you're looking about, you know, Palestine, I think I may have mentioned this on another show. Palestine is actually, it comes from when it was ruled by Romans. So the term Palestine goes back actually millennia, not just centuries, millennia. When you're looking about this span of time, the issues evolve, the people migrate in and out, but generally speaking, you're talking about the same base of human population that is in an area, right? And they developed this society, generally in Palestine, that was never really led by one ruling faction. It was always outsiders coming in, right? And when it transferred into the power grab, that was the expansionist era, right? I think late 1800s, going into the 1900s, when everybody was running out of land, you know, particularly the U.S., they like to call that age the imperialist era, the imperialism of the U.S., when you look at this time, right, when everybody's trying to make a deal or how can we cause a small rift in a population in order to take control there, right, causing revolutions. When you look at how things started to be done and when it was just inevitable, in my opinion. Now, I didn't live in those times, but if you're looking at it as a historian, it's inevitable to follow the track and the logic that at some point there was going to be attempts and efforts to colonize the Middle East. Right, because it went to Africa, it went to South America, went to the Americas, all the Americas. It went to further parts and island nations, right? Think Asia and over by Australia and its connecting parts. It was inevitable it was going to come to the Middle East where there was no foundational nation. You were talking about the Ottoman Empire at the time, right? Before Israel's creation, before this was the home of the Jewish people. This is the area that we're talking about. And this is the population as well, right? You got to think that this is, it's wrong in my opinion to call them a barbaristic society because it's not, they just developed in their own trajectory, in their own system, they developed it to the same point as the Europeans. And it may not have been as effective as a trading system or as effective as a law system because it spent so much, in my opinion, so much more time trying to solve its inward problems, right? When you're talking about the Ottoman Empire falling, you're talking about many states that very much like a big state breaking into many independent states was the same thing, right? So you have one controlling power that very loosely had power. And as it starts to fall apart and every single little piece wants their cut, right, you think about different people representing certain interests, or maybe they're nefarious, or maybe they're good interests, depending on your point of view or who they are. This is the area that we were talking about where Israel is trying to come in the early 1900s, late 1800s. And someone that I would really, first of all, I'm going to link in the description. You should absolutely go listen to Martyr Made. Martyr Made, the first six episodes, I believe, that were ever done on that channel. If you go look it up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, the breakdown of the historical timeline of the Israeli-Palestine conflict going back as far back as you can go when Israel was a thing, which is not forever, what people may not want to be honest about, right? Israel the term and concept always existed. And that's not what I'm trying to take away. Not always, but going back to biblical times. But Israel, the state, existed, I believe, in 1948. And from 1948 on, now we're talking about an Israel. But how did we get to an Israel really existing? It's important to look at. Why is it important to look at? Well, it was forced on in a colonial manner. All right, so what you got to look at, and I'm going to be skipping history. Like I said, I may have mentioned already, but I'm going to get some things wrong in this show. Bear with me and correct me where I can. I will come back to this, and I probably will be talking about this again. Unfortunately, this is one thing I want to mention before we go here. This is Israel's longest war, what we're dealing with right now. Allegedly, longest war since the 1980s. Going on 6 months, it doesn't look like it's stopping. And it, other than a little bit of slap on the wrist in public demeaning, it really hasn't been any stance taken from Biden in America, who is their biggest donor, in stopping the activities that are happening that are causing so much of the world to look at this as an atrocity. It's hard not to look at it that way, in my opinion. But I digress. As we start to look at how this longest war since X happened, I think what we're going to start to realize is that this war has been months. We've had ceasefires in between. This has been going on constantly for years and honestly decades at this point. We'll get to that later. Again, butchering this history a little bit, so forgive me and correct me. However, in Israel's creation, okay, so what you had was a time of revolution. You have to think this is in the same time frame of Marxism, communism, starting to come into the fray in Russia, in China, right? So the 1900s, you're starting to see what's happening in Japan, especially after World War I and leading into World War II. Actually, some of the earliest actors in World War II. And all this time, right? You have to think it wasn't just the Germans that were coming after the Jews. Okay, so you have to understand this point where you're talking about the Jews as a people really have always been persecuted, and as has at some point in time, almost every single religion has faced persecution, and a lot of them still do today. But the way that Jews were persecuted was very personal. Okay, and this is where this myth comes in, that Jews have like control of the world, they have control of the weather, they can make things happen with money that nobody else can. This is where all this stuff stems back to, okay? And what they called these things were pogroms. It's one of the most evidentiary cases to look back on historically. And what is something you could point to that was happening to the Jews, right? Because daily discrimination, yeah, of course it might happen and you might have to rely on someone's story for that, but you're also relying on someone's story. It could be undersold. It could be oversold. You're never really going to know unless you've lived in it yourself. What a pogrom was is basically a sanctioned killing, or at least an effort, a non-effort, I should say, by local or military forces not to step in the way when there is a public outrage against Jewish people, especially in places where they lived. So think about, you know, Eastern Europe, you're talking about places in Russia, places in Ukraine, okay? Of course, places like Germany, but where I believe the name pogrom, I'll go look this up actually, where I believe it comes from is actually of Russian descent. Yep, it's a Russian word, and it is to wreak havoc, allegedly. Now, these pogroms would happen, and it might be pogrom. Apologize if I'm getting that wrong. You're, like I said, looking at basically sanctioned killing spree of Jewish people. And living through this constantly, I believe that there's a, if you go listen to some of Martyr Maid and some of what Daryl did with his show there, it's just incredible and harrowing, to be honest, a real effort. But I believe at some point mentioned there's hundreds, and if I'm not mistaken, somewhere upward of 500, 600 pogroms in a year. In a 12-month span. And just imagine towns all over the nation just grabbing pitchforks and going after one group of people. That's what we're talking about. We are talking about life as a Jewish person. And this is pre-1900, right? This is dating back into the 1800s. And if I'm not mistaken, it could have been going on for a lot longer than that. in different ways. And we look at this killing spree and how you would actually react if you were in their shoes, right? And understandably, at the time of many revolutionary movements, like I mentioned earlier, you have Marxism, communism, socialism, all these different trains of thought that start popping up, and Zionism is actually one of them. All right. Now, what Zionism is I'll butcher this, and I'll butcher it on purpose, but basically it is a Jewish person believing that there is a Jewish state in Israel, where Israel is located today. There are plenty of Jews who are not Zionists. There are a lot of Jews who are Zionist, and most of them living in Israel are, or at least descendants of Zionists. This movement spawned at the same time with a lot of the same leaders from communist movements and taking up a lot of the same revolutionary mindset type of people from the same areas, right? This movement spawned in Russia. You have to think about, now, this is someone that I want you to do all the research that you can, because it's a figure that I've yet to read enough about to really determine just how impactful, but seemingly the creation of Israel, or at least the idea of an Israel or a Jewish state, stems from Chaim Weizmann. Now, Chaim Weizmann, Russian-born, like I said, coming from these areas that are tending to be quite revolutionary, or at least spawning these people who are just going to wreak havoc on society, depending on how you're looking at it, right? Where what they're seeking is a place to live, their people to move to. Also, without considering who is in this place. When you think about who you're displacing in order to place a people, right? Where are you going to get the land? When it's more of a pie in the sky thought, right? And for most of these Zionist leaders actually living in, at this point, friendly places for Jews so that they can participate in government. You're talking about places like England at the time, France, okay? They never really had any intention of moving to Israel. They, in a lot of cases, weren't discriminated against in any way, shape, or form like people from Eastern Europe. And by this time, really what they were arguing for was political gain. And what came out of this? There are two agreements, two statements, I guess. Two things that I think you should absolutely go research, go read yourself. I'm not going to take the time here to read it verbatim. Two documents that I think are very important if you really want to understand the background of how Israel became a state is go look into the Balfour Declaration first. Okay. This is a declaration, to my understanding, and to brief summary, this is a declaration stating by England that there will be a Jewish homeland set up out of the state of Palestine. Okay. Now, the Sykes-Picot Agreement is what's next. So, not to butcher this, because it's a very intense subject in of itself, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, but what it did was negate previous agreements made with Muslim nations in order to take their own land out of the Ottoman Empire. And it redivided the conquest of the Ottoman Empire between France, Britain, and this new Israeli state that was about to come, sectioning off, like I said, other people's land. And this colonial mindset coming into an area where it was not fully understood at how quickly and how pervasively it takes over a society and a people's total way of life changing. Not understanding what's coming down the road, at least at first, there were a lot of efforts to make life between Jews and Arabs, what they called, or Muslim people, at least livable, right? Understanding that there was going to be a people migrating in, and more the arguments started to become, look at the anti-Semitism, right? Anti-Semitic, mostly being propped up by Zionists, right? But this argument started to crop up, and it starts to crop up a lot more once you start seeing what's going on in Germany in 1936, especially, and you start to see a massive migration of people into the Middle East, coming in, settling Israel. And what they're doing is basically making cash offers to people already living in this Palestinian area and buying up whatever land they can and disallowing those same people that they bought this land from, disallowing them from work. And in doing so, you start to rob a culture, you start to rob a certain identity from an area. And as you see this coming, more and more and more people are being sent away as a, basically looked at, not basically, this is word for word, looked at as vermin, looked at as rats by another type of people, another tribe. As this persecution goes on in not only Germany, but Eastern Europe, I should say, Russia, Ukraine as well, as these atrocities start to kick up and more Jews are displaced heading into this land of Israel, which might have been at the time the only place accepting Jewish immigrants. When you look back and you try to make sense of what the feeling is, right? You try to imagine what that feeling is of having your home invaded, might be too strong of a term, but your home is being overburdened with more and more people that don't look like you, don't talk like you, don't act like you, and certainly don't want to have daily commerce with you. And this is your home. And you may have lost your home to these people. I put myself in that sphere as best I can, and I can only hope that I would understand how each side is feeling, because one side is saying, well, if I don't come and I don't leave, I'm going to be killed. My family is going to be abused. My family is going to be probably killed as well, or used for slave labor. And I need to take this opportunity. And in some cases, you literally have land, jobs provided, nothing to worry about, essentially, moving to this new place. And on the other side of the coin, you're looking at someone who, yeah, they may be able to flash you enough money to pay your rent for the next few months now. Maybe not even that. Maybe even just enough to get yourself fed for the night, get yourself a place to stay. You're watching this happen to you and your home and your family. And how you react, I just can't fathom it. I can't imagine it happening here in America today. But you try to put yourself in those shoes. How do you not react or treat this as an act of war? How do you not treat this as people coming and ripping, like I kind of mentioned before, ripping a culture out of a place? How do you not see it as that? Well, in a way I do. And I think it plays a lot into, well, the Israel that we have today. If you look back again, the foundation of Israel itself, 1948, okay, when all this work gets done, you know, different kinds of Zionism coming in. And again, I allude you to go listen to Martyr Made. Go get a little bit deeper of a depth conversation if you enjoy the podcast. And if you don't, he has so many references to books and articles and different pieces of even first and secondhand information that is so crucial to understanding both sides of this conflict going back. How quickly after World War II was this place officially claimed Israel? And following up on that, once this state was installed, we'll say, immediately they're at war. And generally speaking, that makes sense. Your revolutionary wars take a chunk of an empire, right? Generally speaking, that's what it is. Or they overtake the entire state itself. Okay. But how this occurred was, I don't want to say unnatural, because it seems very much painted by a human brush, but it's a European mindset coming to a place that's not Europe. And it's not, when you look back on it and the amount of times that it's worked out for the European nation that actually sent the original investment, there's a lot of times you look back on it, you look at the UK and what they did with the colonies and what kind of position it puts them in now, being able to be diplomatically strong, politically strong, it's nearly impossible. They're constantly in debt, right? And you look at the US's trajectory now and how I would say we're definitely paying out the waz for mistakes made centuries at this point ago, militarily, and overreaching and overstepping our bounds. It's become a point now, it's so obvious at who and what the objectives are and who's perpetrating those objectives, at least to me. All right, so you follow this logic, you see at war. Now I'm going to go over to the history of war with Israel, because to me it's fascinating. Okay, so of course you had your War of Independence. Now you have basically everybody against Israel. You have Egypt, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Yemen. You look at these times and you think about a birth of a nation. Well, it was an automatic war. It was a conflict of religion, which is one of the most sorely felt. And I know for myself, definitely, but for people around the world, it is your base of belief and your base of knowledge. And other than that, you're also a different people, like I said earlier. When you talked about the Jews that lived underneath Muslim rule under the Ottoman Empire, well, if they were Jews that had lived there thousands of years, they weren't Europeans, they weren't displaced peoples. And when you talk about this new population coming in, the effect that it has on everybody around them, trying to recognize what's actually happening. Like I said, this is a slow process begun at the turn of the century in the 1900s. Balfour Declaration and Sykes-Picot, I believe, were between 1914 and 1916. Slow buildup to a mass migration in the 1930s, escorted by Hitler and his regime and his policies. And you think about your reaction. Think about if it was you, right? On both sides of this issue. And you start to understand why this conflict is very deep. All right. And for someone to say, oh, they've been fighting for thousands of years, or they've always been fighting and they will always fight, I think that's part of the reaction of not wanting to understand the deepness of the true situation. And I'm telling you guys, I'm just hitting the surface here, trying to give a brief overview so maybe we can have a dialogue. But it's tough to close this stuff down and try to summarize, because it gets so expansive. And understanding this issue, it takes time, and I don't understand it yet. I feel like it's one of those things, as soon as you start picking away at it, you realize you uncovered a whole iceberg underneath there. But my point of this show is to bring to you the understanding and the background and creation of a nation out of really nothing, and in a place where I think it is not really accepted. And that needs to be something that's understood, right? As Americans, we are the supporting nation of Israel. We are the largest supporter. And it is, I would say, without our help, it is possible that they don't exist. How should we feel about that? Is it necessary for us to take this burden on, right? And I'll go back to this war history, right? And I'm going to skip ahead a little bit, because I had many very spontaneous wars, and some very quick, very small numbers, going back to say the 80s, the 90s. But what I want to focus on is, when did Hamas start coming into the fold, right? Because when you look at what's going on with Israel, it's a lot of the same enemies over and over and over again, coming to peace agreements and then breaking, coming to peace agreements, coming to ceasefires, breaking. It's constant. So they started off, they were going after Egypt constantly. So you have War of Independence, Sinai War, the Six-Day War, War of Attrition, Yom Kippur War. Going all the way up from 1947 to, what is this, 1973, they were fighting the same enemy in Egypt. Some of that included Syria on and off. Some of it included Yemen on and off, right? Jordan on and off. Every single time fighting the same enemies up until 1973. And then we take a break here. We're actually going to go against the PLO, okay? Palestinian Liberation Authority, if I'm not mistaken. I don't actually know what the PLO stands for. Let's go make sure there. Yeah, no, that's what it is. Palestine Liberation Organization. I apologize. So the PLO being their main target for, you know, decades again, going on to a decade. Fighting since about the late 60s to the 80s. Okay. And as soon as they're done, you're going to start to see a name that will pop up continuously. And that is Hezbollah. Hezbollah has allegedly been a target of Israel's or a enemy of Israel's since the 1980s. You go back to 1980s and to today, we're already hearing them. We still hear them. So talk about four decades of war against the same enemy on and off. That's an interesting dynamic that we haven't seen in the world really since, did you have the 30 years war, right? I think you had many instances of war carrying on over a decade. And it's really because war was slow. It was a war machine and it wasn't actually mechanized, right? You didn't expend tens, if not hundreds of thousands of lives per month. That just didn't happen. And now all we all know, you stay at war with another nation for multiple months. You're talking about tens of thousands of casualties at a minimum, right? And now I want to point to our other main figure, right? The Hamas organization. Now that pops up directly after what was going on with Hezbollah. Now, it's actually going on a lot at the same time. Starting in the 1980s, we were dealing with Hamas, and we will continue to deal with Hamas as Israel. Going on, you have a war going on with them from the 80s to the early 90s, the early 2000s. You also have 2008 to 2009 is when the most recent fighting, I would say, really kicked back up. And then you have constant attacks between the two of them going in 2012, 2014, 2021. Now we have what they're calling Operation Iron Swords. I already mentioned the numbers earlier, but to understand the ramifications of killing 30,000 people of a population that isn't that big to begin with and starving the rest of them, let's just understand this. Understand what our efforts support here, what our dollars support. So these numbers are just devastating. You're looking at 30,000 deaths for Palestinian people. You're looking at over 70,000 injuries, and the numbers for Israel are just, they're just not nearly the same. You're looking at still not really the numbers, actually gone below 1,200 people dying in total for Israel, which is what they claimed during the October 6th attack. And not only that, the ongoing casualty rate is extremely low and majorly off balance in Israel's favor. How much longer can it continue? When does a true ceasefire happen? I don't know. But what I do believe when you look at it from our perspective as Americans is understanding that we don't have to sap the blame on Israel, but without anything serious like cutting off our aid or making sure that our aid is going to operations that are actually in the best interest of the United States and not just Israel, that's something that's needed. Okay. And I think without the next president taking that step, and here's the thing, Joe Biden does not seem like he's stopping his role or stopping proposal of bills to send them more money. And if you look back, and this is one of the major problems that I have with Trump getting in here, is how does he treat the Israel situation? He was the most Israel-friendly president, I believe, ever. Okay, and might have to fact check me on that, but if I'm not mistaken, he sent the most money, made the most negotiations, and definitely offered the most amount of peace to Israel ever. Understanding that, how does he come in and treat this situation? Does he continue to aid them in their war effort, or does he try to negotiate a peace and really get this thing settled? I would like to know, because right now I don't understand where he would be going with it, and I am a bit fearful that it will just be 4 years of it, if not more. Like I mentioned a little bit earlier in the show, and what I want to call back to and end it on is when you look at the way things are, it's always actually a world war. We don't even have to call it World War III. The amount of people that are involved in relationships in order to run a country, the amount of alliances you need to have, the amount of backers, kind of people buying your stock. If you don't have that, you don't make it as a nation, right? And we need to understand that too, as just regular viewers, regular people. What these nations rely on most is having other backers and having people that go along with their plans, right? It doesn't mean you spill every word of it, and especially not in military operations, but what it does do is it puts them in a position not to do something stupid unless they think it's not stupid. When we're looking at what the war has become now, the amount of people that are involved, the amount of different nations that are involved, it's serious enough to warrant a conversation that we're implicating ourselves in a worldwide war again. And what is it really for? Well, we don't know, because all we know is that money is flowing one direction or the other. Somebody must think they're right in the situation. But to be honest, from an outsider perspective, and I think pretty clearly to everybody else, at least that has somewhat of a heart, the situation's disgusting from both sides. It's disgusting. And to see that this is a continuing conflict that just doesn't seem to have a resolution, it starts to make me think that maybe we need to rethink the entire plan of an Israel state in Palestinian lands. And it's something that's not really considered whatsoever anywhere else. But here's the brutal fact of it. If you guys cannot maintain peace with your neighbors, what are you going to do to us when we stop cutting you off? Are you going to fire at us too? A genuine question. What do we do in this situation where we are basically bound by the knee to a peoples that seemingly, if we're to believe the tabloids, we don't have control over? We send all this money to, but we can't tell them not to fucking stop killing innocent people. When it gets to that point, and I just hope that everybody, again, went off on a tangent there at the end. I'm done for the show. This conflict, again, I am not the smartest guy in the conflict, and I don't really know shit about it. What I do know is that it's a hell of a lot more convoluted, and it's a lot more serious of an issue than people give it credence for. But the problem is it's so complicated that it's scary to talk about. Well, that's what I'm here for. I want you to drop your comment down below. Let me know what you think of the show. Let me know what you think of some of the points that I brought up. Did you learn anything? Do you have a correction for me? And most importantly, what do you see as a solution to this problem? Because listen, moving Israel is not going to happen. Okay. Moving Palestine is not going to happen either. Okay. Getting Hamas out of there? Well, you can only do so much unless you're going to be willing to launch a coup like America seems to be fond of lately. Unless you're willing to do that and find measures to do that type of operation and then deal with the fallout there when they don't go along with your plans later down the road, to me, you need to let people separate, get themselves away from each other, and cut the war out. Someone stand as a middle ground saying, no, if you're going to attack these people, you're dealing with a hell of a lot more than just these people. And I think you're going to see it. I think you're going to start to see Muslim nations band together out there in the Middle East and really start to protect one another when it comes to their interests in regards to Israel. You're already watching it, but I think it's going to get pretty severe. And it's going to be a matter of, in my opinion, can the other leaders of other nations come in and negotiate a peace in which the two sides actually agree to put it off for a bit, go live their own lives, do what needs to be done trade-wise, don't stop commerce, make sure that other people can survive, stop hurting aid, but let's finish this war thing. And unless someone comes in like that, all I see is realistically either a whole bunch of not so great economically speaking countries are going to have to band together and go to war again, which is the United States, most of Europe, right? And you're going to have sides picked on a grander scale trying to intervene on the other side. Now, does it get to that point? We'll have to see. Okay. Do I think it comes to all-out war? I would like to say no, because the economics just don't make sense of it. We don't have any money to spend, and yet we continue to print it. It reeks of a disaster to go to war. That's all I'm saying. So it doesn't really make sense there. But the way these things work out is normally 180 degrees ass backwards from what you planned. And What I do get worried about, and what I do hope that our next leader can take to heart and really start to build a solution from, is we need to stop feeling so held down by the way that we do things now and start finding a way to make things better in the future. All right. Negotiating deals that are the same deal that was negotiating 10 years ago, it doesn't work with modern people or technology. And I think people need to realize that, and leaders need to realize that. And coming to a solution, especially for this conflict, which is, like I said earlier, based in religion, based in that core heartstring of a person, if you can't treat that properly, well, I think you're going to get exactly what you're looking at. Again, sorry for ranting. That's the end of the show. I hope you enjoyed it. Hope this conflict can find resolution.
I want to be something, not nothing. Trapped inside my dream and I'm running away from these demons. But the feeling's so good, I'ma keep dreaming.